on radio, streaming live on investtalk.com, and for our podcast subscribers. This is InvestTalk, above average investing for the average investor. InvestTalk is made possible by KPP Financial, a registered investment advisor firm serving clients throughout the United States. And now, KPP Financial Executive Vice President, Financial Advisor Justin Klein.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to InvestTalk. This is our Monday, July 20th edition of InvestTalk 2015. And our mission, as always, is to help you become a better than average investor. Stick out from the crowd, you know, not follow the crowd when it comes to making your investment decisions and ultimately have better returns because the crowd has below average returns. And a reminder to all podcast subscribers, just like our radio listeners, you can call and talk with us live 4 to 5 Pacific time, Monday through Friday. Same number, 888-99-CHART, C-H-A-R-T. Now, what lesson can you take away from today's program? Now, in addition to answering your questions, which is our first priority, Stephen, I like to bring some ideas or emphases to certain principles that might otherwise slip from your attention. Now, from time to time, we get questions about options. Do you understand them? Do you understand options? Now, the world of options can be very complicated because it's a derivative. That's what options are. They're a derivative of another financial asset, usually stocks. But if you can grasp the basic concept, they can be a great tool. Options can be a great tool for the average investor, but they are very complex. And I'm talking about speculating on major price swings that can be fraught with a lot of danger. And it's not for the beginner or even the faint of heart. But what I am suggesting is that you take the other side of speculators' trades and sell them options. Remember, 85% of options expire worthless. So being an options writer, meaning selling options, can be a great income strategy with less risk than owning the stock outright. Now, here's an example of what I'm talking about. Say you like a certain stock, right? XYZ stock. Trades $100 a share, just for round number purposes. And you think it's undervalued. Well, one basic strategy is to write an out-of-the-money put option with a strike of, say, 95. You know, if you're going to buy it at 100, why not buy it at 95? Expiring next month, you get $2.50 a share. That's kind of a high for an options yield, but it's for example. That gives the buyer of the option, the right to sell you that stock for $95 a share. Now, since one option contract is equivalent to 100 shares, you get $250. Now, say that stock does fall to $90 within the contract period, and you are put the stock. Well, then you basically bought the stock that you liked at 100 for $92.50, 95 minus $2.50 a share. Now, you may be stuck with a loss, right? You have, if it's at 90, because effectively you paid $92.50, but it's only a 2.7% loss as opposed to a 10% loss if you bought the stock at 100. And if the stock does not fall, rather it stays above 95 when the option expires, well, you get to keep that $250. Doesn't seem like a ton of money on a potential outlay of $9,250, but if this happens on a consistent basis, you can build strong income that way. So it's a strategy that some people use, but it takes a lot of time and effort to do things like that. Now, do you have questions about options? We're here for you this hour, and we can answer any money questions. Our number is 888-99-CHART. We'll take this question now from our 24-hour listener line.
Hello, Steve or Justin. This is Mike from Washington State, and I was listening to your podcast from Friday. Steve was talking about IRAs, and I had a question about SEP IRAs. When I was working, I was self-employed. I invested in SEP IRA. And now that I'm retired, what should I do? I heard somewhere the possibility of switching it over to a regular IRA of some sort. If that's a financial advantage, I don't know. If you could give me some insights on SEP IRAs and retirement, I'd appreciate it. Thanks a lot. I enjoy your program, and I look forward to hearing more from you. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right. He's asking the basic question is, he has a SEP IRA. He's self-employed pension, basically, plan for your own business. And the big question is, can you combine a SEP IRA with a traditional IRA? And the answer is, yeah. Technically, they're the same type of account. They're both IRAs. They're both tax deferred. The money you put in, you haven't paid taxes on yet. And when you take it out, you will pay taxes. So from a tax point of view, they're one and the same. A SEP, you can just put a lot more in, but you have to be self-employed, etc. So there's some rules around when you put money in a SEP versus a traditional, but you can combine them. And there's some advantages to it. One is most IRA holders, meaning the broker that is holding that IRA, usually charges an IRA fee. It can range from, I've seen them as low as $15 a year to as high as maybe $50 a year. So if you can, and if you have multiple IRAs, then you can, you know, combine them all to one, and you only pay one IRA fee, right? So that's one advantage. Another is just simplification, you know, keeping track of a bunch of different accounts. So we always say for everybody, they should try to combine as many accounts as you possibly can for fee efficiency, for simplification of following a particular portfolio. And it just makes more sense when fees as well. When I talk about fees, I'm also talking about commissions. If you're going to buy a certain stock in one portfolio and a certain stock in another, well, it's $7 a trade, right? And if you're going to buy Apple in your SEP and Apple in your traditional IRA, why don't you just combine it all and buy Apple once, right, for example. So it does make a lot of sense to combine those accounts. And for everybody out there, if you have old IRAs, combine them. Put them together. Doesn't make sense to have them scattered around. Now, is now the time to get defensive? That's one of our talking points today that I want to get to, but I also have some others as well. I want to talk about some frugal habits of the world's richest people. You know, most people think of money and wealth, and they think of extravagance. Well, that might be true for the professional athletes out there and the rock stars out there, but the ones, the millionaires and billionaires of the world, most of them aren't living extravagantly. They aren't on yachts every weekend, traveling on the world in mega mansions, etc. Sure, thousands of them do, absolutely. But most are fairly frugal. So I'm going to talk about what are those frugal habits that maybe you should consider for yourself as well, and maybe temper down your expectations or your ambitions for what you want what to do with money. Because from all the people I know that have had a lot of money, experienced a ton of wealth and a ton of a lavish lifestyle, most of them will say it's not all cracked up as everyone likes to make it. I also want to talk about 5 tips to save for $1 million for retirement. So how can you get to $1 million or more in retirement? Simple steps that make a lot of sense. Okay, so we're going to talk about that. I also want to talk about the shadow banking system. You read about it a lot, at least I hope you read about it a lot. If you aren't reading about the shadow banking system, know about the shadow banking system, whether it's here or in China or wherever in the world. You need to know what that is. What does that mean? What is a shadow banking system? Why is it different from a traditional bank? Whether it's a commercial bank or investment bank. You know, those are, you know, a commercial bank are JP Morgan's, Bank of America, Wells Fargo. An investment bank is Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, etc. But there are other financial institutions that are getting bigger and bigger every year. A lot of it's because of Dodd-Frank. but it does have wide-reaching implications. Okay, so I want to discuss that and make sure all of our listeners are up to speed on what the shadow banking system is so you can incorporate it into your broad thinking. So those are my talking points today, but ultimately I want to hear from you. 888-99-CHART is our number. 888-992-4278 is how you get through and ask your question on today's show. Let's talk about the market today. We had the S&P was up 1 point. The Nasdaq was up 9 points. The Dow was up 14 points. Small caps were actually down. Commodities took it on the chin once again with the strong dollar, but I'm seeing a lot of seems like capitulation in the commodities market. So that's going to be interesting to see how that finishes up the month. A lot of strong selling, a lot of volume, but does that mean we're at the end? Possibly, but not necessarily. So you got to watch for how we finish up the week, how we finish up the month. Those will be especially important. Now, Steve has a new date for portfolio checkups. It's August 4th in San Jose. Steve will be meeting with a limited number of listeners on that date. I know he has a few meetings already lined up, but I think he has about two appointments left. So if you want to save your spot, just go to investtalk.com, click on the Make an Appointment button. Let's go to David in San Jose. How you doing, David?
I'm doing all right. I had a question about Vivint Solar today. I own some shares and just a couple of questions actually. A, how to play this merger deal, because I'm kind of novice, so I don't understand everything that's involved in this. And then secondly, there was also breaking news about certain legal firms and them filing action against Vivint and how that affects everything. So I'll take your answers off the air and I appreciate your time. Thank
What
you.
was the name of the company you're talking about?
Vivint Solar.
Gotcha. VSLR.
Correct.
Gotcha. And you said that they got bought out. Who did they get bought out by? I didn't hear any news on this, so I'd like to get a little up to
Oh,
speed.
sure. Yeah, of course. Sun Edition. There was breaking news this morning about Sun Edition purchases them for about 2.2 billion, I think it was.
Okay.
It's
And
roughly
you own
30
shares currently?
Correct. I own shares of Vivint Solar. So,
Gotcha. And what was the shareholder action that you were discussing, or the lawsuit? Is that what you
I'm
said?
not sure. I was only able to skim it at work. I really am not able to really
Gotcha.
feed into it at work,
Well,
but.
I'll tell you this. Most of the time when companies get a buyout offer, especially a company like this that's a solar company, there's a lot of them out there, and Vivint might be great, but there's probably not a lot of other suitors for a company like Vivint or in the solar industry right now. If this is the biotech industry where there's a ton of suitors in the biotech space and everyone's trying to buy out, the next firm, then I could say there might be more bidders. But the odds are low that there's going to be another bidder, so I would just sell it and take your money. Could there be more upside to it? Sure. But the 90 plus percent of the gain is probably in it, and the biggest risk is that this deal falls through and and then it comes back down from $11 where it closed on Friday to from about $16 around the close today. So I would sell it, move on, be happy you made money and find another company to invest in.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
No problem, David. Thanks. I'm glad you're with us for Invest Talk. What do you want to talk about? What questions should you be asking? Does this investment match my investment goals? Is this investment suitable for me? What are you thinking about? Can I help you come up with some good answers? Give me a call. We have about 40 minutes left in the show. 888-99-CHART is how to reach me right now.
Thanks again for subscribing to our podcast. Stocks are close to their most expensive in years. It has to be frustrating to be a value investor, right? Beyond high price tags, value managers finding bargain stocks. That's our talking point for Tuesday's podcast.
Let's go to Syed in Oakland. How you doing, Syed?
Hi, how are you?
Doing
Yeah, I
well.
have a question regarding both, like options.
Okay.
Okay, what happened? I bought an option put on Intel. Was a strike price at $29.50 on Friday.
Okay.
Expired and $29.47. So at that time I didn't sell the option, didn't exercise anything. So I thought it went to zero. So now I get a call from the broker and say that I have the money due because I sold 300 shares. I didn't trade 8 shares. I just traded the option at 68 cents. So can you explain to me how that works, the put option?
Okay, let me get this straight again. So do you own Intel right now?
Well, I don't own it. I bought the option at 3 contracts. But
okay.
Now the broker is telling me that I...
So you didn't, okay, so did you buy, a call option?
A put.
Oh, you bought a put option. $29.50. Okay.
Put option on $29.50.
Okay.
And it expired at $29.47, and then I did not sell the option at the end of the day. It just went zero, so I didn't expire, you know what I mean?
Are you saying that you didn't execute it is what you're saying?
I didn't execute it. The broker is calling and said his money owe now.
Yeah, so you sold it at $29.50. So it closed at $29.47. So it's going to assume that you wanted to execute it. And so that's what it did.
Yeah, they did that for me.
Yeah, so they did that for you. So now you are short Intel. You are short 300 shares of Intel.
Yeah, that's what I expected. But yeah. I didn't know that because I did not buy that stock itself. I just bought the option. So
doesn't matter. You still are obligated to whoever bought that. What happened was somebody who had the stock at $29.47 saw the stock at $29.47 executed it and said, I want to sell this because that's what you gave them the right to do. Sell it at $29.50 and I'm going to buy it at $29.47 or $45 or whatever, right? Whatever they could buy it at. But so they made that 4 cents or whatever. And you were obligated to, you know, sell that to them at $29.50. So you are now short Intel, 300 shares of Intel. Now what you need to go do, and luckily it's down today. I don't know what it'll do tomorrow, but go if you don't want to be short Intel, then just buy it back. $29.10, you made money. Or at least I don't know what you, I guess you sold the option. So you'll make money.
$29.10 right now.
Yeah. So you need to go to your broker and say, I want to buy to cover 300 shares of Intel.
Oh, so I don't have to give them the money because they asked me for the money.
Yeah, exactly. You're short it. I don't know if that's a margin call or not, but you're going to have to cover it at some point. And the big question you have to ask yourself is do you want to be short Intel? And now, it's in a downtrend. It's probably not a bad stock to be short. But obviously there's still risk with being short.
Okay. So now every week when the option expires, if I don't do anything, they're going to execute the option for me. So I have to sell it. So this way I don't have to be in this situation.
If an option expires in the money, in the money. So for example, that's what happened was Intel expired in the money, meaning your put was at $29.50 and it was below that number, $29.50. Therefore, it expired in the money. That means that stock is going to be put to you at whatever that put price, $29.50. Most likely, because somebody is going to execute that, and they did.
But if it doesn't close in the money, it just closed higher or lower.
Exactly.
It would be a different story.
Exactly. So if it closed above $29.50, the odds are good that it wasn't put to you. Now, somebody who owned that put could actually execute it before it expires. So maybe, usually it doesn't happen unless it's the day of, for example. And so that's probably what happened late in the day on Friday was somebody had your put option and they bought it at less than $29.50 and they executed the option and sold it for $29.50 and made that spread. That's likely what happened.
Okay. Oh, okay. So I did understand that. But I'm not now. I just have to buy it back, and then I don't have to lose money. So
exactly.
I don't have to come up with the cash for them because they asked me for the cash. That's $8,000.
You got to have that cash.
That's how much they've calculated yet for 300. Shares.
That's
for only 3 contracts. You know.
That sounds about right. Or 8,000, but that's pretty close.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah, thanks,
so if I buy it back, then I don't have to owe them money anymore, right?
Exactly. Thanks for the call, Sayed. Hope it goes well for you. I would do it early in the morning, too, if you can. He was asking about Intel. See, that's how complicated options can be. That's a good example for, you know, we talked about earlier in the show that you have to understand what you're getting into. Options are not for the novice investor. They're great tools. They can be great tools. And the fact that he sold the put option was good. But he also has to understand what that means. All right. Now, coming up in the next half hour of Invest Talk Personal, 10 signs you might be a victim of identity theft. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein. You can reach me now at 888-99-CHART.
Now is a good time to call InvestTalk.
Do we have a disadvantage, us investors, on the West Coast as opposed to the people that are closer to the action? They're right there in New York.
And what's your question? 888-99-CHART is how to reach Justin right now on InvestTalk.
Is it now time to start getting defensive with your portfolio? Well, you know, we can argue that until the cows come home, and you know, I could argue on both sides of it, depending on how you want to discuss it. But the big question is, how do you get defensive? Now, some people might go to more cash, some people might short the market, etc. But one way to get defensive as well is to move into defensive type of sectors. Now, the big question is, what sectors are defensive? Now, most people are going to say, usually the layperson is going to say, well, healthcare is usually pretty defensive, right? Because no matter what the economy is doing, we still want our drugs and we still need to get surgery and go to the doctor, etc. And that's certainly true. But in today's day and age, you have to understand that healthcare is not treated equal. At least all healthcare funds are treated equal, because typically many healthcare funds, whether it's ETF or mutual funds, they have some exposure to the biotech sector. And if you think about it, and you understand the valuations there, the biotech subsector of healthcare is very hot and it deserves a lot of caution. The valuations there are out of this world, insane, very bubble-ish. It's just a matter of when is it going to burst, not if. So if you're going to buy into the healthcare space or get more exposure there, try to avoid biotechs. Now, one way to do that, there's the Vanguard Healthcare Fund, Vanguard Healthcare, which doesn't really have a lot of exposure to that particular area of the market. VHT is the symbol. So that's a good way to think about it. And then there's consumer staples sector. And we all understand the defensive nature of this. It's no matter what the economy is doing, we need to take showers and brush our teeth and, you know, clean the house, etc. And we want to be exposed to companies that sell those particular types of products and services. Now, that doesn't mean that if the market goes down, these two sectors won't go down. They probably will to some extent, but usually less than the overall market. I mean, their beta is less than the overall market. For example, the VHC that I just talked about VHT is the symbol. I'm sorry. Come on, my computer's being slow today. Come on, show it to me. I know the beta is low. Actually, the beta of that one's 1. That's kind of crazy. Usually, healthcare sector is much lower, but this just shows you that typically healthcare and consumer staples, they are less correlated to the overall market. Say that, and then finally, there's utilities. Utilities have taken on the chin recently, and that's all because of interest rates. As interest rates go up, utilities tend to get hurt because they're a bond alternative, and as yields on other types of bond assets go up, well, utilities become less attractive. And they also borrow a lot of money, they're highly capital intensive, etc. But if that fear, and I think in a lot of ways, is unfounded. So utilities to me, if I'm going to get defensive and I still want to be in the market, utilities are the best area of the market right now. Okay? So just be aware of what constitutes a defensive position, and understand that defensive doesn't mean without risk. It just means maybe lower risk than you typically would expect from the equity markets. Now, your questions come first. Whether you have a stock or strategy question, we're here for you at 888-99-CHART.
Hi, my name is Gary. I listen to your show by podcast from Massachusetts. My question would be on a stock, Gilead Sciences. The symbol would be GILD. I'd like to know your valuation and where you think it might be in a couple years out, and if now is a good time to buy. Thank you very much. Have a good day.
All right, he's looking at Gilead Sciences, a very good company. This kind of segues nicely with my discussion just recently, a minute ago, about the biotech sector, and Gilead is a biotech name. And they certainly have very good growth. Revenues last quarter at 52%, although that's a slowdown from about a year ago of 136%. Earnings were up 99%, so it's fast growing, fairly low P/E ratio. The biggest issue with Gilead is there's two. One is the biotech sector. If the bubble comes out of biotech, the bubble will affect Gilead as well. The bubble bursting will affect Gilead because of just its connection to the biotech space. And then B, they have a hepatitis C drug, and it is very effective. A lot of people will say it's a cure, but it's also very expensive. I believe it's $1,000 a day for 80 days or something like that. It's very, very expensive. And there's a lot of pressure from the industry on them to lower their prices, not just from the industry, but also from Congress that has asked them to lower prices or is pushing them to lower their prices. So there's certainly risk there, and that makes up the bulk of their earnings. And if something happens with that particular drug, Gilead could go down a lot. Now, I'm not saying it's going to happen, but there's certainly a lot of risk there. And the fundamentals are still good with Gilead. The fundamentals are still strong from a ratio perspective, a cash flow perspective. It's quite robust, I'll say that. But there is certainly a lot of risk with Gilead. So if the pressure from regulators and pressure from the industry doesn't push their prices down, and there aren't any fallouts from the treatments that are being administered with their drug for hepatitis C, years from now it could be a lot higher than it is today. But it is definitely fraught with risk. So it's one of my favorite biotech names, but a whole sector is a big worry. All right. So that was Gilead Sciences. Now it's time for Invest Talk Personal, the day-to-day money choices we make that can have a lasting impact. 10 signs you might be a victim of identity theft. Now the Credit Bureau TransUnion calculates that every single minute, 19 people become victims of identity theft. And the average cost to that victim is $500 and 30 hours to fix it. The good news is that you can protect yourself by catching potential problems early and enlisting the support of your financial institutions. And here are some tips compiled by USnews.com. Now, if you lose your credit card, let your card issuer know right away. You'll get a new one, and the customer service representative will let you know if any erroneous charges have already been made. So be quick. Don't lag. Call your issuer as soon as possible. Number two, avoid using ATMs in obscure locations because it's easier for thieves to install scamming devices or skimming devices on them that steal your information when you swipe your card. So you know those little podunk little ATM machines in the back of a liquor store, etc. I'm not saying they're all an issue, but know that when you use them, you're exposed to a higher likelihood that you're going to be a victim of fraud, of identity fraud, because there could be something installed on them that steals your information. Number three, check your account statements for errors. You might see an unexplained or inaccurate entry, such as a withdrawal, a check, an electronic transaction, or a purchase that you don't recognize. Number four, look for mistakes on your credit report as well. You may see a credit inquiry you don't recognize or a new account you didn't open. That could suggest someone else is impersonating you. Number five, respond to calls from your bank. They might notice a problem before you do. They usually do. And be sure to call them back to sort it out. So if you call from the bank, don't think they're hounding you for payment or whatever. There's a good chance that they're calling to make sure that a transaction you made was correct. And if a message comes in the form of an email, make sure it's not fraudulent. This is huge. Check with the bank before you respond to any of those emails, because a lot of them will take you to a website and get you to put in your login information, and it looks totally legit. It might have your bank logo on it, but that does not mean, or does not necessarily mean, that it is actually coming from your bank. It's this very good way that thieves try to get logins and passwords from users so that they can now access their bank account. So email, remember, emails are number one. Whenever you get an email, make sure you know who it's from. And I'm not just talking about your bank. I'm talking about all types of emails that can come in that can try to get you to reveal information about yourself. Make sure you're 100% sure it is accurate. And that's Invest Talk Personal tomorrow. We'll have five more tips to avoid being a victim of identity theft. There's a link to this on usnews.com as well under our talking point link on investtalk.com.
Shopping for dividend-paying stocks or tax-free bonds? How much risk will these add to your portfolio? How much risk are you willing to take? Our risk analysis tool is there to help. It asks simple questions and helps you put a number on your risk tolerance. Try it. Takes about 5 minutes or less. It's there for you on investtalk.com.
Hey, Steve, Justin, love the show, guys. Hey, I was calling with a question on some terms, and I've heard you use them. This is Mike from Charlotte, by the way, listening to you guys on podcast. The terms are specifically support and resistance. So we talk about a stock or index rising to a resistance or catching support on the down end. How can you, I believe I understand the terms, but how can you identify where support is or where resistance is by looking at, I guess you look at a chart and tell that. So any explanation I'll appreciate. Thanks again, guys.
Well, there are multiple areas of support and resistance on a stock. Some are minor and, you know, probably going to be short term. Others are major and it could take a while for them to break above or below a particular support or resistance level. Now, the biggest ones are usually previous peaks, previous valleys in a chart, an area where it might have broke out from. That is a good support level. If it's coming back down into that level, and vice versa, if it's stock has broken down and it's starting to rally back into a certain level it broke down from, then that is also a resistance level. So support and resistance, a lot of times, is the peaks and valleys and various areas of the chart where there was maybe a lot of trading, a lot of consolidation, things like that. It can also be the moving averages, whether it's a daily moving average, a weekly moving average, 100-day, 100-week, those are kind of my favorite moving averages that I like to use for kind of a lot more of a longer-term perspective. So that's what you have to look at. And It's an art. It's not a science. You have to have experience in these things, and they do tend to come true. They're not 100% accurate, but they do tend to come true. You know, mathematics is as old as time, and a lot of this has to do with mathematics. So there are a lot. There's Fibonacci. There's a lot of ways to figure out support and resistance, but you need to be a technician to fully understand it. Now, what are the five most frugal habits of the world's richest people? I thought this was a great article, because a lot of people, they think of the richest people in the world, and they think of big yachts and mansions and fancy cars, etc. But in reality, that's not most wealthy people. Now, it's no secret that if you have a lot of money, you can have the financial freedom to do more things. Eat out at fancy restaurants, drink expensive wines, etc. But you might be surprised to learn that many of the richest people in the world avoid that type of lavish lifestyle on purpose. Instead of using their wealth to, you know, buy these lavish things, they usually live far below their means. And they've gotten to become wealthy because they live frugally. They save regularly, and like I said, they live below their means, meaning they spend less than they make. Obviously, they make a lot of money. That's not that hard. But very few of them spend up to what they make, right? Now, number one, buy a modest house. Housing costs constitute a very large percentage of most people's budgets. Warren Buffett currently lives in the same house he bought back in 1958. So don't think you need to buy this big lavish house. Buy based on your needs, not just based on your wants. Because if you just buy based on your wants, you're likely going to overspend and waste a lot of your capital on unnecessary home. Number two, only carry the cash that you need. So you don't splurge. Only enough cash to buy what you need. Number three, look for deals. Even celebrities like Lady Gaga, Hilary Swank, they look for deals as well. Number four, pay yourself first, save before anything else. And number five, reuse whatever you can. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein. You can reach me now at 888-99-CHART.
Our podcast distribution is made possible each day by KPP Financial, Steve Peasley, president. Do I need a lawyer when I'm buying a house? Can I pay my house off early without a penalty? Call our 24-hour listener line for answers 888-99-CHART. Or you can get a note directly to a financial advisor about it, and they will respond. To do that, just go to investtalk.com and click on Contact Steve or Contact Justin.
Let's get another question in before our hour ends. Jeff called us between programs from Campbell.
I had a quick question. Is there any way for an individual investor like myself to kind of buy at least some kind of index that's tied to crude oil? So I know ProShares and iShares are tied to oil companies. Is there any way for me to kind of get actually to some financial instrument tied to oil prices?
There is. There is an ETF, USO, but I don't know why you would want to. The more volatile, there's such thing as contango, and that causes a lot of issues with these ETFs that invest directly in a commodity like USO. And same with natural gas. There's UNG as well with natural gas. And so over the long term, it's just going to cost you too much to be invested in them long term. So that's why I would recommend just sticking with oil companies, you know, XLE, OIH, you know, if you want to buy an index and get exposure there, that's where you want to be. Not only is there a higher degree of correlation with oil prices, right? Meaning if oil prices rebound, these ones will do much, much better than something like USO. But also you get dividends. These are companies that earn a return on their money. They're going to return on their investments for you, for their shareholders. Okay? So I rather invest in the actual company, so I don't know why you're shying away from them. In fact, you should be running towards them. It's exactly what you should be thinking about when you're thinking about investing in oils, the oil sector overall. Let's go to Dan in Bonzal. How you doing, Dan? Oh, he couldn't hold. He wants to know what's going on with gold? Is that his question? Gold is on a route. Tons of massive volume. It looks capitulation-like, meaning everybody who wants to be out is out. That may not be true, but that's what it looks like here. A lot of that has to do with the dollar, even though it's not that strong. It is kind of odd. I'm thinking it has something to do with Asia. Because Asia, there's a lot of margin calls, and the quickest way to get a hold of money is to one of the most liquid markets in the world is the gold market. So I think that is contributing to it. And it could, I think it's likely capitulation here at these levels. What exactly is going on with gold? That's anyone's guess. But it is pretty shocking to see the type of declines that you've seen recently, especially with global money printing still at a near record highs, even though, Fed's gonna tighten, but still money printing throughout the world. So it is quite odd. But I think long term, this is a great place to be adding to a gold position. Short term, is this capitulation? I think we'll know by the end of the week, probably, or end of the month. So that's kind of what's going on with gold. Let's talk quickly about the shadow banking system. A lot of people don't know what this is, but it does matter a great deal if you want to understand our economy domestically and a world economy as a whole as well. Now, economist Paul McCulley first used the phrase shadow banking system in 2007 at a financial conference. Now, in his speech, he defined the shadow banking system as financial institutions that do not take deposits, like a traditional bank. These are things like hedge funds, special purpose entities, special investment vehicles, mutual funds, etc. And they're not subject to the same regulations that banking is subject to. Because bankers, right, they take deposits and you need to have some safety there, etc. But usually the shadow banking system are private companies backed by investors. And they make most of their money by acting as intermediaries between large borrowers and large lenders. And they earn revenue from that interest rate spread or fees they charge for their service. And they can be quite complex. So understand that this is a big part of our financial system, and it comprises now about 25 to 30% of the global financial system. It isn't small. It's approaching a third, and it's growing every single year because of Dodd-Frank. So I just wanted to let everyone know what that is and have our listeners understand that this is something that you need to incorporate in your grand thinking about our financial system. Now we're out of time for today. I'm financial advisor Justin Klein. For Steve Peasley and everyone at KP Financial, thank you for listening. Enjoy your evening. Let's talk again tomorrow.
Because of the nature of the interactive dialogue inherent in the format of this program, it's important for listeners to understand that not all comments made will apply to them specifically. Nothing said shall be taken to be investment advice, or shall statements on this program be considered an offer to buy or sell securities. Such advice is rendered solely on an individual basis, and at times will require that the investor review a prospectus before investing. Steve Peasley and Justin Klein are principals of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, a registered investment advisor. For more information regarding KPP's investment advisors, call 1-800-557-5461. InvestTalk is a copyrighted program of Klein, Pavlis, and Peasley Financial, which retains all rights.